the sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Reb and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, let me begin by wishing everyone a very, very happy, healthy Passover. And for all of the non-Jews listening, you are guaranteed of a week of good weather. So any plans you want to make, just know we have your back. It's a special time of the year. And, you know, with all of the heartache, and there is much of it, all you have to do is, you know, listen to the news. I'm looking at Noam Laden as I say that. Listen to Noam Laden every day, and, you know, you hear the depressing news. But yet, when you talk to Noam, he's a very, very positive person. And I think Passover says you have to temper the pessimism with optimism. That's why you put the, you know, the haroset, the sweet combination, that sweet mixture on the bitter herbs. To me, that is a responsibility we have as faith leaders, too, to convey that to people.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to our conversation with our guest today, because we're going to sort of break down the Seder. Mm-hmm. I was fascinated when the first time that I was invited to attend and experience it, the meaning, the time that it took to reflect, to think through, to understand. And I think you and I had this conversation, all right, because our audience is diverse. You know, we have Christians, we have Protestants, Catholics, we have Jews who tune in, and probably, you know, beyond that. But you and I had a conversation about the ability to have conversations with those of other faiths. Mm. And you made a very important statement that interfaith requires interfaith. Mm-hmm. Expound on that in the few minutes that we have before our guest comes on.
One of the things I have learned over the years is I need to be proficient in my faith. I need to understand my faith well if I'm going to have a serious, substantive conversation with a person of a different faith. Because we're going to compare notes. We're going to talk, what does this mean for you? What does it mean for you? Well, in order for me to tell you what it means, I have to know. So I find the interfaith experience gives Jews and non-Jews that special moment when we can have these kinds of discussions about difference and realize that we can sit together at the same table and talk about how different we are, and also recognize that we have, you know, much in common. But unfortunately, we live at a time where difference is not in vogue. You can't, if you want to be different from the other, don't sit at my table. You know, I always love when people get an invitation to an event, they say, where am I sitting? Who am I sitting with? Right?
Yeah.
They want to sit with people who are similar. And we say, no, you got to learn to sit with people who are different, because that's the reality of life.
I like the interfaith part. You said interfaith requires inner faith. Yeah. And I like that interfaith part, because what you're suggesting is that you have to have a deep connection with your own faith. You have to be rooted and grounded and committed to your own faith in order to really appreciate a dialogue with someone else of another faith. And unfortunately, Rabbi, I think that too many people have a very shallow relationship and shallow understanding of their own faith these days. It's almost like I'm culturally Christian, culturally Jewish, culturally
Jewish light, we
Muslim
call it, Christian
or whatever.
Light.
Christian light. They really don't take the time to have a firm grasp on their own faith. And yet, when you do that, interfaith dialogue becomes enriching. It just shows you how anchored you are in your own beliefs when you sit and have a conversation with someone from another faith.
I remember Cardinal O'Connor saying once at a service, I don't want Jews to become Christians, and I'm looking for Christians to become Jews. I want Jews to be better Jews, Christians to be better Christians. And I think all of us need to see and ask ourselves, how can we be better? How can we know more?
Yeah.
And we have a guest today who I'm sure is going to touch on some of these topics, Rabbi Elie Weinstock of the Jewish Center of Atlantic Beach, president of the New York Board of Rabbis.
Yeah, so So stay tuned for more of the dynamic duo this Sunday morning, the Rev and the Rabbi, right here on 77 WABC. We'll be right back.
Where faith matters, the Rev and the Rabbi, Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Costa.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, we are honored to have a good friend, guest of the program, Rabbi Elie Weinstock, who is the spiritual leader of the Jewish Center of Atlantic Beach, and he is the president of the New York Board of Rabbis. He's a prolific writer. He sends me very often, many others are privileged to receive his thoughts, and they're all very, very creative. So good to have you on the program, Rabbi.
It's great to be here, Rabbi. Reverend, good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we always, or traditionally, wish each other in Hebrew Chag Sameach, a happy holiday, a happy Passover. This year is different because of all that has transpired since October 7th. How do we deal with that, Rabbi?
It's running through my mind, and one of the taglines of the holiday, of the Passover holiday, is Manish Tana Halayla Hazeh. How is this night different from all other nights? And your question, you know, really hits the nail on the head in terms of, with so much national trauma with it, facing the Jewish community, what's going on in Israel, uncertainty, rising anger and anti-Semitism in the United States. That's the answer to the question. That's how this night is different. And how it relates to the happy is that I think there's another part of the Passover Seder service that answers that question. We talk about how it's in every generation we have encountered difficulty. And it's not just Pharaoh in Egypt that was the challenge, we say. Ella shebechol dor vador, every generation there's been that challenge. And on some level, that those challenges, those pressures have shaped us to allow us to try and transcend and to try and find the freedom, find the goodness, find the way forward, no matter the difficulty. This year it's very much felt, and I think more than usual, calls to try and introduce ways to recognize or honor the situation have come forward. Just this morning, the president of Israel made a very heartfelt plea to leave an empty seat at the Seder table for those who have been killed, those who were murdered, those who were being held hostage, and to have a very real way. Look, everyone will have their personal memories, but nationally, we have to put an empty seat at that festive Passover table because that's how the Jewish community has responded throughout history. Mm. You know, that's, you know, human beings move forward. And I think that it's very similar to be asking someone the question these days, how are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, okay, not okay. You know, it's a complicated question for any person in a crazy world today. A couple of the answers that I like, one is like, doing the best as possible, or we're all doing the best we can. Everyone's in the same ship in a crazy world. And within the Jewish community for Passover, we're all in that same ship in terms of feeling some loss, some trauma, some pressure, but we go forward. And sometimes you don't change the greeting, even if the sentiment is going to be very different. And, you know, so I still wish people a Chag Sameach, a happy holiday. But the holiday will be different, but we still try to find the joy in those difficult times.
Rabbi, this past week, the news was covering protests at Columbia University. Jewish students have expressed their fears and concern for their safety on college campus. You have to reassure your congregation. Some of them feel some of those seats occupied by young people. What do you say? How do you encourage them? How do you, you know, communicate with them at a time like this?
So it's a great question. One of the most common words I hear from individuals, whether it be the students, whether it be the parents, is unsettled. And, you know, I don't want to talk politics, but I'm a radical optimist. That's the party I affiliate with. I think it's very complicated. And I think, you know, being there and hearing from the people who experience it is different than necessarily watching it on the news. it's difficult. People want to express their positions and their opinions, but sometimes if those opinions are just spewing hate, that's difficult and that's a problem. And I think that I try to respond and engage those who are feeling unsettled with the encouragement that we have to remain stronger in our views of what is goodness and what does it mean to engage and what does it mean to be kind and what does it mean to be proud? What does it mean to be patriotic? You know, you talk about a lot of the protests, and even from what, you know, makes its way into the media coverage or on social media, you hear, you know, the protests that are generally respectful, you know, whether it be, you know, people who are Zionists or supportive of Israel or supportive of the U.S.-Israel relationship. They're generally quiet, respectful, and patriotic. They're Israeli flags and American flags. Generally, the gatherings and the protests that are turning violent and aggressive, there's a lot of screaming, a lot of yelling, and not a lot of flags, not a lot of patriotism, not a lot of recognizing that it's one thing to dispute ideas and opinions. It's another to, you know, spew delegitimization. I try to get people to focus on, you know, carrying forward, heads held high in a positive direction.
Yeah, you walk down the street, happens very often here in Manhattan and so many other places, you see the signs, kill the Jews, Hitler was right, you know, from the river to the sea, calling for the elimination of the Jewish state, and in many cases, the elimination of the Jewish people. You don't see that at the pro-Israel rallies. What you see is stand strong with Israel, and we stand with Israel. I was telling Rabbi Weinstock, Reverend, this past week, that we at the Board of Rabbis are going to undertake an initiative, and we're going to have rabbis all around the state of New York meeting with students and saying that we're going to be there with you. We want to walk with you. We want to stand with you. We want to show you that you're not alone. And I think one of the reasons students also feel alone is not just because of the ugly protest on campus, but also they have administrators who refuse to enforce, who I think in many cases are timid or cowardly, are allowing students to run the affairs of the institution rather than they. I mean, I saw some of the responses at Congress. You know, when you're a leader, you have to have a spine. And we have, I think, leaders who they're not fit for that position. And therefore, we have to come in and say, we're going to be with you. We're going to stand with you. And I think that has to be the position of the Jewish community. We hear you. And by the way, not just the Jewish community. There are many good people. Rev, you're one of them. You have stood with us for all these years, and it's reassuring to know that we do have allies of different faiths who say we will not close our eyes to the pain you're feeling.
You know, I think about the Seder and walking through the elements, the bitter herbs, the sweet paste of fruits and nuts. And, you know, we formulate sermons, and I'm just thinking about what that message is going to be during your celebration as you go through the elements, you know, the wine, the bitter herbs, the roasted lamb shank. Do you translate that into what's happening today? Because, you know, it's rooted in the Exodus story, but that story has changed the lives and trajectory of so many communities over centuries. What are you going to say? How are you going to relate what's happening today to the elements in the Seder, Rabbi?
So I think finding relevance, both from a Jewish religious perspective, remember the Seder very often is the family. It's the opportunity for the family to pass on tradition. So I think there's that component, and you want to make it relevant to the next generation, as well as the Passover relevance to religion, to all mankind. And I think that, you know, very much so, the idea, the symbols and the order and the rituals provide an opportunity, you know, from your question, you know, the bitter herbs in particular, what is bitterness? And, you know, who feels the bitterness? And what can we do if we're combining the bitter herbs with the what they call the charoset, you know, say that 10 times fast, but it's the mixture, sort of a kumpat that's meant to emulate the bricks made out of nuts and apples, so there's a little bit of sweetness. So part of the Seder ritual is to combine the two. So there's bitterness and there's sweetness, and you know which one stands out, and how do you quell the bitterness, or how do you, you know, move forward with the bitterness? So I think that there's definitely the opportunity to ask the question, well, we're commemorating the bitterness, what kind of bitterness? And that bitterness ended with the Exodus. Well, what about the bitterness that's being felt today? On all sorts of levels. And I think that, you know, one of them, this is what was really one of my main messages this year, is that we know that the holiday is called Passover, and that's how it's translated. And that's very much influenced by Greek and Roman translations of the Torah, of the Bible, of the word Pesach, which technically is Paschal, right? The Paschal Lamb. Pesach is Passover because God passed over the homes of the Israelites in Egypt during the final plague of the killing of the firstborn. So very easily people say, oh, Pesach, that's Passover. What's interesting in the Hebrew is that the word Pesach is also translated. It's used this way in some of the other books of the prophets. In the biblical commentaries, note this: Pesach means compassion, because on that night God showed compassion to the Israelites in the process of taking them out of Egypt. So, really, at the core of the Pesach holiday, in addition to commemorating a passing over, is compassion. Is the other. If those around the table, those who've been invited to the table, humanity, there's a very strong interpersonal, impactful element that runs through the Passover holiday, in which we do have to make it relevant. Maimonides very famously instructs that you should shake up the Passover Seder. You should do things that people will ask questions, so that people will think it's out of the ordinary. You know, so you talk about bitter herbs, and you talk about green vegetables in salt water. There was a rabbi who used a banana and dipped it in salt water. Now, if you see a banana being dipped in salt water, it's probably out of the ordinary. You're going to ask a question. And the rabbi did that for that very point, to make the point of asking the question, why are we doing this? How is it relevant? And I think the symbols are a wonderful prism for making it relevant in terms of how we feel bitterness, how we ease bitterness, how we celebrate, how do we include others in the celebration, how do we talk to each other? It's a lot of conversation at the Seder as opposed to screaming past each other.
You know,
it creates an opportunity to connect with family and community through ritual and meals. I think it's a brilliant idea to institute that. So what happens? You invite other families, or is it just your immediate family? How does that work, rabbis, plural?
Well, you're always invited, Reverend Bernard, not only to the Passover Seder, but to everything. I just want to add this, that I spent some time with Elisha Wiesel this past week, the son of Elie Wiesel, and he's been a guest on radio. And I heard that his father, Elie, stood at his father's grave after the Holocaust, and he looked at the grave, and he said, I wish I could tell you that the world has changed. And his point is that the suffering continues for so many people. And Elisha has now been involved in the Uyghur tragedy in China, where people, you know, are placed into camps. You can go to, you know, the Rohingya in Myanmar. You can look around the world. Iran. Look at the people who want to overthrow the government. So when we talk about freedom, I think we can make it extremely relevant. All of the people who are yearning to be free, who are still enslaved, the hatred that continues, not just against the Jews. I mean, you look at that audit of ADL, and I wasn't shocked, because all, you know, through since October 7th, we've heard all of these increasing incidents of the attacks. But even before that, but you see it against other people as well. So I think that story is very important for us, but I think others can relate to it as well, and you can expand on it and say this message has great meaning today. I would also add that when Shakespeare spoke of sweet sorrow, I suggest he plagiarize it from the Passover Haggadah, right? Because, right? That's sweet sorrow. Here you are, you're tasting bitterness, but you temper it with sweetness, and I think you also have to tell those young people in particular that in spite of it all, or nevertheless, we're here. And we've endured all of this, as Rabbi Weinstock said, but we are here. And that says something about the resilient spirit of our people. Rabbi, you want to add to that?
100%. I think that, listening, Joe, to the list of sorrows out there, it's a reminder. It's a sobering reminder. And in, I think that there's a lot less serious reflection as to what needs to be done in a micro level, around the table, around the family, around the community, of the neighborhood, city, state, country, world, that doesn't happen the same way anymore. Sometimes people joke that, the first question asked at the Seder table is not how is this night different, but when do we eat? Mm-hmm. Because it's a evening that can sometimes take a long time. And part of that is the reason why it should take a long time is we need to have a little bit of patience to understand that things are complex. People don't really like that anymore in terms of complexity. The attention spans are 6 or 7 seconds before you start tuning out. There are 120 characters. It's TikTok. It's things that we want to be able to know everything very quickly.
Yeah.
Certainly matters of faith and matters of morality and matters of history, continuity, civilization survival are not so simple. And that having that deliberative approach is helpful. And the Seder goes through all of the different states of that journey from the Israelite historical perspective, but also speaks to the human condition. Right? We know, in terms of the accoutrements of the Seder, how it impacted, Christianity and Christian practice and Catholic ritual. We know some of the experience of the Jews in Egypt, and Moses influenced a lot of some of the black hymnals with regards to the slavery experience, mm-hmm. and their experience, mm-hmm. in America. Let my people go, Moses. These are very powerful images and stories and experiences that. It's great that Jews have that Passover day, that Passover Seder one time a year experience. I'll leave it with the idea that there's actually a Jewish obligation to remember the Exodus daily, and that's not we don't have a 3-hour Seder daily, but we remember the Exodus daily because these ideas and themes are supposed to stay with us.
Right. One of the things that I appreciate about religion, and that is the codification of faith into ritual and practice, because it keeps us aware of the past and links it to the present. The roasted egg, and Rabbi, forgive me, I'm going back to this, the roasted egg, which symbolized mourning, but also the cycle of life, correct? So where is the hope that comes out of this celebration of this meal?
So I say, hope is in a sense that North Star that we're all looking for to what comes next. Your observation and question for me comes to mind as an expression that's part of the end of the Passover Seder. It's actually the last line of the Yom Kippur liturgy also, and it's next year in Jerusalem. In Hebrew, it's L'shana Haba B'Yerushalayim. And this has been built into the liturgy for hundreds of years. It's been recited in times and in places where there was little realistic expectation that it would actually happen. Right, if you're in a concentration camp on Passover, and we have stories and recountings of Seder experiences in the concentration camps, going through the liturgy by heart and ending L'shana Haba B'Yerushalayim next year in Jerusalem, or if you're Natan Sharansky in Siberia, right? These are not necessarily realistic opportunities, but there's the possibility or the expectation of what's something going to be next. I think that's built into who we are as people. I think that's definitely very much a part of Jewish tradition. I think that's what faith is about, and maybe sometimes expressing that faith, even in a situation where it seems the darkest of moments and the unlikeliest of eventualities, but to still express that faith in that next year and better and more. And being in a more exalted or enhanced place, That's how we express that. And I think that that in
that's
particular, it's a theater.
Yeah, that's so important because, you know, we have a line that we cherish in our New Testament in the Christian faith. And the words are, and this too shall pass.
You took that from us.
Here we go. Yeah. There we go. What can I say here without plagiarization here? Yeah. But it's important that we know that, yeah, this is for a season, that things will change, that this is not forever. And I think that's the kind of hope that we need, especially at times like this. Rabbi, you were going to say something?
Yeah, you know, the name Shlomo Nagar may not mean much to some people, but he was the executioner of Adolf Eichmann. And after that took place, many wanted to interview him. And he said, I will consent to your interview request on one condition. We're not going to take it at the site of the execution. What we're going to do is take it at a Passover Seder, at a in a school where Jewish kids are learning, at a wedding, at a bar mitzvah. You can interview me there because I want you to know that Jewish history didn't stop with the Holocaust, with the execution, that we are a people that also celebrates life, not just continues to recall death. And I think when you look at that Seder, opening the door, you know, for Elijah, who is the precursor to, you know, the messianic arrival. When you have young kids asking questions, you know, why is this not here? And you encourage the questions and other questions. You know, I was telling Rabbi Weinstock, I saw an article that says, are you on asking terms with your children? You know, we see many cases where the parents and kids are not on speaking terms. Passover says, not only do you have to speak, but you have to be able to ask each other questions. So I think if you look at that pervasive message of hope in the Haggadah, in the story, it is predicated on our belief, as you and I have said, Rev, we're prisoners of hope. And we don't just close the door and say, it's over. But we open the door and say, the best is yet to come.
Yeah.
Rabbi Weinstock. You got
amen to that.
Yeah.
The best is yet to come, and I think that it's, you know, to kind of go full circle. It's sometimes in those darkest moments where we're presented with an opportunity to put our faith to the test, and brings out the greatest within each of us, and that we're able to say Happy Holiday when there's so much noise and darkness and madness around us. That's what it. That's what that hope is.
You know, Rev and Rabbi, one of the things that I find disturbing, and I don't know how this is in Christian tradition as well, is young people will say, oh, I remember my grandparents' Seder when they had, when we were there for Passover. Wow, we went on, and we had this wonderful experience. And they talk about the past. And it bothers me because we can't allow Passover to be a celebration, you know, that was done by grandparents and has not been continued throughout the ages. So how do we inspire young people to say it was important to previous generation or generations? It has to be important to us. How do we get young people to be more engaged in their commitment to Passover and to faith? What are some of the things we could be doing?
It's a great question. If I had the answer, I'd probably have my own radio show. But the look, I think that, you know, part of it is that young people get older, and sometimes that as they mature a little bit, I also have this hope that some of the angry college students will turn into hopefully more reasonable, you know, more mature adults. You know, at the same time, I think, you know, what young people don't have as much of, since they're very much consumers of information and media, they don't have the opportunity to come up on their own proactively to ask questions or to be engaged. And I think that in several activities, programs, events that we've tried here in our synagogue, and, you know, events that I've seen with other rabbis, you know, through my work with the New York Board of Rabbis, that giving people the opportunity to obviously listen, but also to express and to, in a way, show them that, you know, they may not have had the whole story, and that their questions that may be coming out of ignorance or annoyance, or that kind of spew a certain party line against the establishment, are not being ignored, but are then being answered or responded to in a respectful way. You know, going back to the basics of respect and engagement, I think young people don't get that in their experiences, and providing that, you know, is a powerful opportunity. Now, it is difficult to get people through the door, but, you know, if we, you know, go to where they're at, you know, I've seen this done in workplaces, I've seen this done in community centers, I've seen this done, you know, in public gathering places, you know, to get the people where they're at and give them the opportunity and put them in an environment that's different than just, you know, posting something angry or watching something angry, but to see a genuine dialogue or to see faith in action, I think can be powerful even for the younger generation.
I think that's where we have a responsibility to make our sermons relevant, because young people want to know, how does this antiquated religious faith relate to issues of justice, mental health, personal development, you know, the things that I'm dealing with today. And I think that we as communicators of the faith have a big responsibility to make sure that that's relevant. What say you, gentlemen?
How many different Haggadahs are there today? Does anybody know? Rabbi, I've never got a count. But one of the blessings of having all the different Haggadahs, and also a blessing of the internet today, is you can get so much material, so much background material, so many explanations about the different symbols, about the different traditions, that you can come to a Seder table and be engaged because you're also prepared. And I think it's incumbent, you know, and I see this sometimes, people walk into a church or a synagogue and say, well, I didn't get much out of it. And I said, how much did you put into it before you went in, that now you're saying you didn't get much out of it? And I think Passover and, you know, education comes with preparation. And hopefully some will see it at home, but many will not see it at home. But there are opportunities for learning that on a host of platforms that I suggest people examine. And I think they'll find it very inspiring.
You say both, Rabbi and Rev, to your question, every year there's 10 or 20 new Haggadahs.
Not by Maxwell House Coffee either. Usually all of Maxwell House Coffee Haggadahs.
We call that the OG. But every year there's 10 new ones that go through the Passover Seder, the Passover liturgy, the Passover story.
Right.
You know, there have been Batman Haggadahs and Superman Haggadahs, and I think there may even be a Taylor Swift Haggadah. You know, so
Wait. They're the uninitiated in our audience who don't even know what the Haggadah is as
part
of the
Seder. So the Haggadah is the order, is the liturgy of Passover.
The narrative.
Passover, yeah. It's the narrative that people will utilize. They'll have a book, you know, sort of like the hymnal. Well, you have that on a Sunday morning. We got the Haggadah at the Seder night. And,
so it's the Exodus story, right?
Right.
Correct. It has the liturgy, but every year new editions come out trying to have a different theme. So you will have the, okay, you know, you'll have the funny Haggadah and the serious Haggadah and the Batman Haggadah. You'll have the American Patriot Haggadah. That will try to tell the story of Passovers throughout American history from the Revolutionary War through the Civil War till today. It is a ritual that has given itself as a springboard to creativity towards relevance. So I think that, you know, towards, you know, when you talk about, Reverend, the idea of the sermons being relevant and making it relevant, and as Joe points out, the Haggadah, you know, the Passover Seder liturgy, or talking points for the discussion as you recount that liturgy, is a terrific source for creativity and relevance.
Mm. Talk about those four kids at the Seder table. You know, the wise, and we say the wicked, and the simple, the one who can't ask a question. What define those more for us? I mean, one of the things that obviously is very important is that kids who are different from one another are all sitting together at a Seder table.
Right.
That's a great moment today.
Right. So, you know, Rabbi's referencing one of the part, the Haggadah narrative, you know, in a nutshell is, you know, they tried to destroy us, we were victorious, let's eat. But it takes longer than that to go through, because you want to have a more meaningful, relevant, full experience to appreciate how the Israelites got to Egypt, their experience there, what happened there, the 10 plagues, etc., going through the story. And part of that is looking at it through the eyes of the children. And it presents four children, usually classically called the wise, the wicked, the simple, and the one who doesn't ask. And right off the bat, there's something, you know, interesting that, you know, the opposite of wise isn't wicked, but that's how it's presented. So it's really four types of children, four types of approaches, four attitudes, and it opens up the discussion on all sorts of levels, whether it be the different children actually that are part of the family, or whether it be the different styles of engagement with religion or with Jewish ritual, whether it be different generations of affiliated, more affiliated or less affiliated, or more observant or less observant Jews. For example, last year, there was a renaming or a restyling of the four. Instead of the wise, the wicked, the simple, and the one who doesn't ask, they were recast as the active, the affiliated, the ambivalent, and the alienated.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that's good.
So,
yeah.
You know, so the idea of finding, you know, basically it's, you know, the kids at the table, the people around the table are all different. Let's, you know, try and appreciate the differences that exist at our own tables, let alone that exist throughout the world.
Interesting.
The holiday begins with the removal of the, I'm going to try my best, the chametz.
Good.
Yeah.
You know, my tutoring helps.
I'm working my way. Good. See, it's helping. Of course, historically, it's because there was no time for leavened bread. But what does it symbolize today that it begins with the removal of something? And what is it that we need to remove from our lives? Are there things that are detrimental? Is it a time for reflection as to those elements of our life that are not productive? What does it mean?
So I would say the answer is yes. But the idea of removal of the chametz, you know, the chametz is technically leaven, and it relates to the fact that as the Israelites left, their dough didn't rise, so all they had was unleavened bread, matzah. But that technical historical point has given forth a ritual in a new meaning, both in terms of technical, in terms of getting rid of chametz from in a technical way, but also a spiritual, ethical, and moral analysis as well. As you point out, the chametz, which is something that rises, it can represent the ego, the anger, self-absorption. Mm. Matzah, which is flat, representing humility. And therefore, you know, Passover is a time to try and excise all of that arrogance, all of that anger, and to focus on humility. So there's that symbolic, moral, ethical lesson that can be taught.
All right. Rabbi Elie Weinstock, Rabbi, this has been, I find, a fascinating discussion of Passover. Not only, you know, the celebration of what was, but what is. It's a holiday, a holy day that I think has meaning for all people who are searching for more meaning in their lives. Elie, I just want to thank you for a very special moment where we could listen and learn from one another. My father used to conclude the Seder with the words, Mizan and Dor, we're here. After all he went through, my family went through the Holocaust, we are still here.
And still here. That's good.
Yep.
That's good.
We'll All right. Good. Thank you so much.
Right, wonderful. All right. Reverend Rabbi, great to be with you.
Always a pleasure having you on the program. And we'll be right back with more of the Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC. Stay tuned.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi, Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Rev, you know what I found interesting is when you look at the Seder plate, we discussed the symbols. There are the symbols you look at, and there are symbols you taste. And maybe that says it's not enough to remember. You also have to renew. There are things you have to do. Just don't tell a story. This is what happened years ago. What does it have to do with me now? As you said before, the sermon has to be relevant. And Passover is a wonderful opportunity to give the insights so the young people say, you know, I learned something from this.
You know, our young people push back against tradition, but these traditions really help to pass on our faith from generation to generation. And it keeps it fresh. It keeps us with meaning to these things. And I love it. I love the whole idea. I attended a Seder meal, and it was an amazing experience with some friends of mine many, many years ago.
Yeah, and here we are, people of different faiths who can sit together and say, I can relate to that. That is something that, you know, is very, very special for me as well. And, you know, the everyone, it's a real opportunity. And I just hope people don't see it as an opportunity to have a meal. It's got to be much more engaging than that. And the different questions and also sometimes painful questions and conversations. And, you know, one of the things you find when you ask questions, you don't always have to have answers, but you've allowed someone to ask the question. And I think sometimes in this world today, you know, if you don't have an immediate answer, well, you're not an intelligent person. And Passover says we may not have all the answers for your questions, but we want you to ask.
Especially in Western culture, because Western culture is wired for certainty. We want assurance and certainty about everything. And one of the beauties of the faith, I had a young man, he was 12 years old, one of my parishioners, and his family relocated out of state. But I remember a conversation. He said, Pastor, what do you love most about the Christian faith? And I said, mystery. Mm. That's what I love most. The fact that I have to keep searching, I have to keep asking questions, that we never arrive and then leave it to go to something else. No, it is just filled with an inexhaustible search for meaning and purpose and understanding. And we don't appreciate that the way we should in our society, Rabbi.
You know, when you look at the four questions, there are not immediate answers. That goes through a whole narrative of the story, but I'm asking, why is this night different? You're telling me a whole story. And maybe that's part of it, that you don't get to the answer immediately, that you have to sit and talk, and maybe together you'll find an answer. And you're right, in today's world, my God, people have answers without even asking the questions. They don't even want to hear the question. This is what you need to know. Well, what's the question? So I think Passover has that, you know, inquiring spirit. And it is such a valuable time of the year. Well, thank you. This has been a very meaningful discussion.
Yeah, wonderful conversation. And hopefully our listeners heard something that was informative and inspirational. And, of course, we'll get to talk about our Christian perspective on the Passover as these holidays come around and we can celebrate them. But for now, thank you for tuning in another Sunday with the Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC. Till next time, God bless and shalom.